It's right about now. Right about now. Right about now. Right about now. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Right About Now. I'm your host, Jonathan Small. Thank you for taking the time to join me today on the pod. This episode is brought to you by Entrepreneur Live 2017. If you find yourself in the LA area on November 9th, and you're an entrepreneur or even just thinking about being an entrepreneur, you should really check this event out. Entrepreneur Live 2017. Entrepreneur Magazine, entrepreneur.com, has brought together an impressive group of CEOs, influencers, and innovators to help guide you on how to create, grow, and sustain your business. Go to entrepreneur.com/events/live2017, or you can really just type in Entrepreneur Live 2017 into Google, and I don't have to give you the crazy long URL. And then when you get to the part where it says to enter the promo code, type in ENT-JSmall, and you'll get 20% off admission. That's 20%. Not a bad deal for listening to Right About Now. You get discounts and things like that. We have a great guest today, Melissa Clark. But before we get to her, I just want to thank all of you who voted for my new logo. If you see the new cool Right About Now logo with a little mic and the pencils, see what I did there? It's a little kind of a combo deal. It was a painstaking decision. It was actually agonizing because so many people voted on my Facebook page, gave their feedback, and it was not unanimous by any stretch of the imagination. So I had to basically do a gut check, kind of weigh all the different opinions, and I decided to go with the logo that you currently see. I'm happy I did because I feel like there's been great feedback. Some people still have some problems with the sort of parchment color of it all. But in general, the feedback has been really positive. And listen, if you'd like to be involved in any more decisions about the show, I'd love to include you in a sort of informal focus group, judging panel sort of thing. And if you're interested in that, just shoot me an email at john@writingpartner.consulting, or subscribe to my Facebook page, which is Right About Now Podcast. Anyway, I'd love to bring people in to help me make decisions about the show. After all, it's your show too. On the podcast today, I'm very happy to bring you Melissa Clark. Melissa is what we call a triple threat. She's written for television. She's the creator of the animated television series Brace Face that was on ABC Family and the Disney Channel. She's the author of 3 novels, including Bear Witness, Swimming Upstream Slowly, and Imperfect. And she's a teacher. Melissa teaches creative writing and literature at Otis College of Art and Design in Los Angeles, and her creative writing courses can also be found online at melissaclarkteacheswriting.com. Melissa has some great tips for both professional and aspiring writers, and I think you'll really enjoy what she has to say in the podcast. Plus, her story about meeting Margaret Atwood is a classic. Melissa Clark, welcome to Right About Now.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. I just wanted to find out a little bit about your growing up. You grew up with a famous dad who was a very accomplished writer, Ron Clark, who wrote for the Smothers Brothers show and collaborated with Mel Brooks and others. Were you inspired growing up in that kind of a writer's household?
Yes. Well, I grew up in a writer's household and a reader's household. So my mom was a major reader. My dad was a major writer. He'd be so thrilled you called him famous. he was very under the radar, I think, you know, fame-wise, I would say. So my childhood was comedians at my parents' house. So it was like laughter constantly, dinner parties, drinks, laughter, repeat. And my dad had a desk, like a 2-person partner desk where he would write in his office. And he sat on one side of it and I would sit on the other side with like a little typewriter and yes, try to be him, try to imitate him. And I would write short stories. I'm talking age like 5, 6. So I wanted to be a writer from day one because of him, for sure.
And because your mom was reading.
Yeah, I was always interested in stories.
And do you remember the first story you ever wrote?
No, I don't remember the first one, but I remember I was an only child for 9 years. My sister was born when I was nine. And so I wrote stories about huge families. So I think I was trying to combat my only childness. And so I remember writing just sort of Brady Bunch, Partridge Family-esque stories where there were a million siblings and chaos in the house. And it was very the opposite of my house.
So that love of writing carried over into your professional life.
It did, eventually.
Eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first, you created Braceface.
I did, yes.
So tell us about what that was and how that came about.
So Braceface was a cartoon that was on the ABC Family Channel. It was inspired. I had had braces for, I think it was 7 years. My orthodontist went bankrupt after maybe 3 years of treatment. And then I had to see a new orthodontist. And he said, oh, the first one had been doing it wrong the whole time. So we have to start from scratch. And so this was hell. This was from sixth grade to 12th grade. Essentially, I had braces. And then I was pitching television shows. And this one company was looking for, they were actually looking for boy protagonist for a live action show. It was a cartoon company, but they were trying to go live action. And so I pitched, I don't know, probably 20 ideas, and one of them being a kid with braces. And I called it Braceface, and it was a boy, and it was supposed to be live action. And then, I don't know, within a year, year and a half, it morphed into a girl and cartoons. First they optioned it, then they bought it, and it was years until it finally got the green light and it was made, and it ran for, I think, 5 seasons.
Did you have any involvement in writing the actual program, or was more like your creation?
Oh yeah, no, I was very involved. I wrote, produced, and yeah, created it. And I would go to Canada, that's where the company was, probably 2 or 3 times a year for about 2 weeks each time, and there would be a table of writers, probably 6 or 7 of us, and we would break the story or the season, and then that would take about 2 weeks, and then we'd all sort of go home to write the episodes that we were assigned. And I stayed with it for, I think, 4.5 seasons, and then I actually quit my own show, which I look back and I'm like, I can't quite remember why I quit my own show, except that I wanted to write a novel. And I knew that it would be good timing to have money coming in from that show and have the space and freedom to be able to write a novel.
What was it about novel writing that called to you?
Well, I was always a short story writer, and I was always very attracted to novels and never understood how people wrote novels, because my short stories were 10 pages tops. But I was a big reader and a big novel reader. And I wanted to tell a grown-up story. I was in the teen world for such a long time at this point. And I wanted to tell just a different story, an older girl rather than a 13-year-old girl. And I just thought I would try my hand at it. I joined a writer's group at UCLA, an extension class. I thought I would do it for a semester or a quarter, and I ended up doing it for 3 quarters, where I wrote and workshopped essentially the whole book.
You had an instructor who guided you through it? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And a bunch of other people in the class, and formed some amazing friendships. I'd gone to graduate school and done all this in my 20s, but I was focusing on short stories. And I went in a little snobbily, because I was like, ugh, I have my master's degree. Like, really? I'm going to go take a class at UCLA? And it ended up being fantastic. And I wrote my first book within maybe a year and a half. And then it very luckily got published soon after. That was the first book. All the others have been hell to write and get published.
Well, we'll get to that. But I'm interested why you decided to take a course. I mean, a true confession, I did the same thing. And I had my reasons, mainly because I found it hard to motivate myself to write anything unless I knew I was getting paid to write it.
Yes.
But given your background, your extensive experience, why did you feel like you needed to take a class to get that novel written?
I think the best thing I got out of graduate school was discipline. I was very disciplined, and I missed, while not being in graduate school, I missed the community of other writers, and I just wanted to be held accountable, and I thought a teacher would be able to do that for me. And so I actually apply And I got rejected from one of the teachers.
Oh, my
and
God.
I'm still pissed. I still don't understand.
I'm pissed.
And I got into the other class, and I was like, I can't believe I'm doing this. Like, what? I'm getting rejected at UCLA Extension that I'm going to pay for? I don't understand. But I ended up with the exact right teacher at the exact right time, and it just motivated me. Yeah, I needed the – even though I was pretty disciplined, I needed something about the community I felt I needed. So I was trying to break out of the young adult stuff. Funny, I'm now kind of back in it. Mm-hmm. But I just, at the time I was working in television and I was trying to be on a sitcom. I mean, that's what my dad did. And that's what I just assumed I was to do later in life. I had a million meetings and Friends and Mad About You and all those TV shows. And I never got the job. It was a hard leap going from the fact that I was on this kid's cartoon to transition into like an adult sitcom. Just like I'd have meetings and they'd say like, oh my God, my kids love Brace Face. It's so good. Bye.
You get pigeonholed.
Yeah, you get pigeonholed. And I knew that I would need to break myself out of the pigeonhole. Is that a term? And so I knew that writing myself out of it would be the only way to do it. And it's funny, I did. And then now I'm very much attracted to the young adult world,
right,
on my own volition.
And why? Is that just because you just, that resonates with you, that time of your life and those kinds of characters? And
I think so. I think I teach now as well, and there's some, and I teach college, so they're a little older. They're 18 through 21 and even older. Something about that age group really appeals to me, and they're just in such transition. They still have a lot of hope. They're searching. There's like an identity thing happening with them. And I find it really energetic and exciting. And yeah, that time for me was not exactly blissful or thrilling, but I remember it made an impression, and all that stuff is imprinted, and it's a good way to process.
I think still. Sometimes that the fact that it wasn't such a great experience probably has been the source of many great novels and yeah, TV shows, right?
Sure.
The
it's
suffering.
Like therapy on paper.
Yeah, exactly. The novelist's life. You didn't necessarily think you were going to be a novelist, but you've become one and a teacher. I want to get into your course because that's really super interesting.
Sure. You're many.
Yeah, your many courses. So tell us what you do teaching wise.
So I teach at a bunch of places, but the most steady has been Otis College of Art and Design. So I teach at an art school, but I teach writing at an art school. They're not there to take writing. I'm not, you know, this is not the Iowa Writers Program.
Right.
These are kids who are going to be painters, toy designers, stuff like that. But in order for them to get their degree, they have to take what they call liberal arts and sciences classes. And so I teach literature and creative writing classes. I've been there for 10 years now, and I probably realized year 4 or 5 that, you know, the short story or the narrative, they're barely reading, let alone, you know, writing their own stories. So I figured out how to get their art and writing sort of merged. And I teach, my most popular class is a graphic novel memoir class.
Oh, that's cool.
Where they tell their personal stories through text and image. And you can't imagine, like the first time I taught it, it was like nirvana, because they were writing, they were drawing, they were telling stories, they were forming interesting sentences, and it combined their talent mixed with stuff that I was teaching them. And when they got it, they got it. So I've taught that class for now 5 or 6 years.
So I'm interested, why would artists who go to an art school take a writing class?
They're required to. It's part of, they're getting a BFA. And as I tell them, that's their F. Like that's, they would be at a trade school if they weren't taking literature and, you know, other classes like that. They're not thrilled. I mean, they are not happy when they realize they have to take, and it's not just 1 year, they have to take 2-3 years of these classes. And they didn't come to this school to do that. And so they come in grumpy and ready to fight.
That's so interesting that you're really getting a group of very creative people who are not really wanting to be writers and teaching them to write. So how do you motivate?
Attempting to teach them to write.
Yes.
Not always succeeding.
I'm sure you're more successful than not. Wait, what are some of the things you do to get them excited about writing?
Well, in the graphic novel class, I teach many other classes. Let me just quickly tell you some other classes
I've taught based on the students I'm getting.
I've taught a class called Makers and Making about the process of making art, any kind of art, film, painting, anything. I've taught a class called The Literature of Madness, books about mental illness stuff. Hmm. That's my favorite class. And theirs too, actually. I think they really... they can relate to a lot of the
things. Why did you choose that one? How'd you come up with that idea?
How did I come up?
Because artists are always mad.
Yeah, yeah.
They cut their ears off. And
there's so many artists that have, who struggle with stuff. And the students struggle with stuff. And I thought it would be a nice merging of the two. And I'm sure it's students everywhere are struggling. But art school, something about the creative mind lends itself, I think, to mind struggles. Mm-hmm. I teach a class called In Their Own Words, Artists Speak About about Living a Creative Life. And that was more about like, okay, so you've got this talent, then what? So how are you going to like eat? What happens next? Are you going to have a mainstream life? Are you going to be really sort of on the fringes? How is it all going to play out? But in terms of inspiring the students, I do a lot of writing. I have everybody keep a journal and they have to do writing prompts. And for that graphic novel class, drawing prompts. And one of my favorite things is to listen to a podcast or a radio episode that's of a narrative nature and have them draw the story.
Oh, that's a great idea.
And in panels, like in a graphic novel panel form. And Modern Love, the podcast, is such a great teaching tool because there are these perfect stories that have sort of conflict, crisis, resolution. And it's good for teaching that, how to structure a narrative. And so I'll have them listen to a podcast. We listen to it all together. And then I hand out these templates and they have to draw what they just heard.
So for people who have never taken a writing class and don't know the word prompt, explain what that is.
Oh, so I guess it's an exercise to get the creative juices flowing.
So one of the prompts you do is to have them listen to a podcast and then illustrate it and write it.
Mm-hmm.
What are some other things that you've done that have been really effective that people respond well to?
So I'll do like in the graphic novel class where we read Mouse, the graphic novel, Persepolis. And so I'll be inspired by the literature we're reading. So for like Persepolis, which we just read, it's essentially a story about a little girl living in unusual times. It's about the Iranian Revolution and her memories about it and her family. So I'll do something like write about a time you united with your family over something else. It doesn't have to be the Iranian Revolution, but maybe it was over a breakup or maybe a death of a grandparent or a pet, or I'm giving all negative examples, but it could be
good.
Really
negative
positive too. So I'll have them do that just so it links to the story that I'm teaching about and they can relate better.
Well, let's talk about your process. So when you're writing yourself, mm-hmm. some people have sort of rituals before they write. Famously, do you have a sort of routine that you follow to kind of get you in the writing mode?
I've been so bad writing wise now. No. So my answer is no. My best writing ritual is going to an artist residency. You apply to it, you know, a year in advance. You have to apply to these things, and either you get accepted or not. And you know from our earlier discussion that I don't like rejection, but I have been rejected from many artists. Residencies, but I've also been accepted into a bunch. So for example, 5 years ago, I applied to one in Spain and outside of Barcelona, and I got in and I was there for 5 weeks. And, you know, week one was drinking amazing wine. Week two was reading everything I brought. Week three, I started to write. And I actually did finish the novel that I was working on there. So I find when time is very concentrated, like I knew I was going to be gone for 5 weeks and I had to get tons of work done within that 5 weeks and I get it done. But with teaching and I have a bunch of other projects happening, I feel like the novel writing gets a little bit pushed to the side. And just with technology, I feel I'm more distracted than ever and I'm really frustrated by it. And I've started to meditate in earnest to try to get myself back to the daily writing practice, which I used to do with ease. It's just gotten so much harder.
What do you mean meditating in earnest?
Oh, I mean, I joined a meditation studio because Luckily, we live in Los Angeles and these things exist. So I group meditate. There are classes every day of the week. Sometimes I go twice a day. And when I tell you I'm putting crystals on my belly, I'm going, and it's so not me, but I feel it. And it's amazing. It's an amazing experience. And it's just giving me the downtime and the, you know.
Clears the head.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever do any of the exercises that you give your students to on yourself?
Within class, I do. When they're writing, I'm writing.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
And why do you do that?
Because they're really helpful. And then I come home and I handwrite, and then I transcribe it into the computer, and I have a whole file of in-class writing assignments that I've done. And I'll reread them for like ideas or prompts, just something to inspire me later on.
Share a few more that maybe our listeners can try themselves just to kind of get the juices flowing.
Okay, I'm going to open my computer, and because I brought one in particular that since I was in graduate school. So when I was in graduate school, I taught an undergraduate writing class. So I was like 22, the students were 20. It was a little bit awkward, in my opinion. And I found this excerpt that Anton Chekhov had written a letter. And I'm going to read you an excerpt of that letter. And this is what I use as a prompt often in my memoir writing classes, including the graphic novel memoir. So this is the letter that Chekhov wrote. Write a story, due, about a young man, the son of a serf, a former grocery boy, a choir singer, a high school pupil and university student, brought up to respect rank, to kiss the hands of priests, to truckle to the ideas of others. A young man who expressed thanks for every piece of bread, who was whipped many times, who went without galoshes to do his tutoring, who used his fists, tortured animals, was fond of dining with rich relatives, was a hypocrite in his dealings with God and man, needlessly, solely, out of the realization of his own insignificance. Write how this young man squeezes the slave out of himself, drop by drop, and how, on awakening one fine morning, he feels the blood coursing through his veins is no longer that of a slave, but that of a real human being. And so I have the students start a story with, write a story, do, about, and then they have to write in Chekhov's style about their lives, but in this weird sort of formal style. And I get the most amazing results from people who have never even written before. But because they're sort of following Chekhov's mannerisms or style of writing, which is, you know, a little formal, a little erudite, they plug in their details and it's just incredible. And I've been doing that for 25 years.
Really?
And always getting good results, even from like bad students.
Now, why is this? Because they are able to sort of tap into something?
I think they're imitating. So I'm asking them to imitate Chekhov's style. And as we know, Chekhov is, terms of writing. And so there's something about the formality of it and them being able to plug in their own details of their life. So you would write, Jonathan would write, write a story due about, and you would fill in the blanks. A young boy grew up in New Jersey, whatever the rest of your story is. And it's a paragraph. So I'm not asking for, you need to be concise.
Yeah, an entire novel.
Right. And I think it's just not, for some reason, it's not intimidating. And the students are like, oh, I'm a person. I have a story. I can do this. And they do. And it's incredible.
What do you do with that once they have that written down?
I collect it and I hold on to them for most of the semester. And it's how I really get to know them. Because if I'm like mad at one or one fails the midterm, I'll go look at what they wrote originally and then I'll like soften. I'm like, oh my God, but they wrote such a good thing at first. So it's a good way for me to get to know them. And then I return it toward the end of the semester with notes and just saying how much I enjoy it and what good details they used and stuff like that. Oh, but it's so cool. It's getting them into this idea of writing about themselves, which is not comfortable for a lot of people.
Huh. Because once they adopt the sort of omniscient third person, that they're able to kind of
dig a little
deeper.
Yeah.
Do you prefer to write in the first or third person?
That's a really good question. It depends on the story. I think I often write in a very close third that people, when
What do you mean close third?
Meaning it feels like first, but it's not. It's an intimate, it's like not a distant third. It's more detailed maybe. It's like my first book is written in third person, but people think that it's written in first person.
Because the narrator is like very conversational.
Yeah, it's familiar, it's conversational, it's detailed.
So who have been some of the most influential writers in your life? The ones that you read that really made you want to be a writer and that you suggest other people read?
So Dancing Girls is the short story by Margaret Atwood, that a short story collection that made me want to be a short story writer. And so when I applied to graduate school, I wrote in my essay all about Margaret Atwood. And I think I specifically wrote about Dancing Girls. And I got into the program. And my second year there, I got a call from the head of the department saying, guess who's coming to our department for a week? Margaret Atwood. And we know that you are so inspired by her. And we want to know if you want to be in charge of her. Pick her up from the airport, take her out to dinner, shuttle her from class to class. And so I said, no, thanks.
That's not what you said.
And I jumped at the opportunity, of course. And
were you nervous? I mean, this is like your idol.
Yeah, beyond nervous. And I thought, this is my chance to sort of pick her brain and just see the inner workings of Margaret Atwood. And I'm so lucky I get to spend all this time with her. And she came, and let me just say it was not love at first sight. She almost was like a four-year-old child with a million questions. From the second she got into my car at the airport, the seatbelt like closed down on her like they,
yeah,
like
came
they do
down.
Right,
yeah.
In certain cars. They automatically sort of get snug around you. And I think she might have had half an hour's worth of questions about the seatbelt. How did it do that? What is? Can you ever stop it? Do all cars have this? How do you know that it's going to work? Is it going to, if you get into an accident, will it drop down as well? And I was like, is she kidding? Are we really talking this much about my seatbelt? And then she had questions about personalized license plates, I remember. And then about, there were a lot of olive groves in Davis. And she had many questions about olives. And, you know, she's a writer. So, of course, she has lots of questions.
She's in a different reality, though. She's so, I guess, such a strange attention to detail. Like,
yes.
Little details, like almost OCD, it sounds like.
And I'm like 22 and I don't have the answers. She at one point asked me what my sign was, my astrological sign. And I was like, wait, Margaret Atwood, the brilliant Margaret Atwood, cares about astrology? I mean, I cared about it, but I didn't think she would. And I said, Virgo. And she said, ugh, Virgos are the worst. And I felt obviously very defensive because I am a Virgo, can't do anything about that. And it turns out that her ex-husband was a Virgo. And she was just raging on Virgos. And I felt I had to defend myself and said, well, maybe male Virgos are different than female Virgos. And she was like, no, they're just all awful. And it was just very surprising to deal with her in that way.
Yeah.
And in fact, when she left to then go to the women's department. And I was slightly relieved.
The moral here is don't always meet your idols.
Run the other way if you hear your idol is coming to visit.
Yeah, it's better to keep them in a pedestal in your mind.
Keep the illusion. Keep the illusion. She's only human.
Now when you read a Margaret Atwood book, do you have a different sort of thought about it?
Well, she's been in the media so much lately for The Handmaid's Tale. I mean, seeing her on the stage at the Emmys I was like, what questions did she ask all those writers?
And flashbacks.
Yeah, olives.
Seatbelts and olives.
But no, I'm thrilled for her success. And, you know, that book came out so long ago. And it's just great that it's gotten all these accolades recently. I still love her.
Any other books that had a profound influence on you?
In Cold Blood, Truman Capote. And I've obviously read it when I was younger, but I've taught it recently. And so I've read it and probably three times in the past 5 years. And that is a thrilling one, too. Of course, that gave birth to the true crime stories. And he pushed the genre forward with that. And it undid him. I mean, it really personally undid him. And I see why. I mean, his obsession is so palpable in those pages. I think that's an incredible read. And that's a true story, but that's totally, and then what, and then what, and then what, defined. And then, you know, I'm blanking on the name of the book, but there's an author, a Southern author, I would call her a contemporary Flannery O'Connor, yes. Named Blanche McCrary Boyd.
No way.
Have you, you know her?
She was my teacher.
Shut up.
She was
shut
my
up.
Teacher for shut, 2 years.
Shut up.
That is amazing that you know Blanche Boyd. When you said Blanche Boyd.
Oh, she goes by Blanche Boyd. I know her as Blanche Boyd. McCrary Boyd.
I am in shock. This is live.
Oh my God.
No, she
I
was my teacher
her.
At Connecticut College. I took a short story class with her.
Oh my God.
And a journalism and a fiction writing class with her. And I'm friends with her on Facebook. And she's an amazing writer. And
right?
Her class is what really led me to be a writer
oh my
in the first
God.
Place.
Come on.
That
Come
was
on.
It. We've never talked about
Ever.
Blanche Boyd.
And in fact, the only reason I mentioned her is I was cleaning out my bookshelves the other day and I was getting rid of a lot of books, which is so painful. And I found her little area on my bookshelf. And I thought, oh, my God, I can never get rid of these. I loved these books when I was in graduate school. And I haven't read them since then, but I'd like to read them again.
That is amazing. Now, what is it about
humor.
Professor Boyd's? Yeah, she's
yeah,
funny.
So funny. I remember I would read, this is back in the day, when people cared about hearing stories in a way that maybe they don't anymore. But I remember friends would come visit me and I would like, read them a short story from her. Like that would be an activity.
Yeah.
Was we'd sit around the dining room table and I would read a short story and we'd be laughing. We'd be crying. We'd be laughing so hard. Just so good.
That's wild.
I can't wait to hear.
I got
to
bring Blanche onto the show. I just realized.
I got to befriend her on
Professor
Facebook.
Boyd. Yes.
Oh my God.
I'll
I saw her read when I lived in San Francisco and it was great. It was
She's
funny
an eccentric and interesting
yeah, very
really
quirky.
Wonderfully inspiring person. I remember she wrote me once a comment on one of my stories that said, this is immature, irrational, dumb, and I can't believe you wrote it.
Like, oh my God.
You, which I was a weird backhanded compliment.
Right. Right,
I was
you're
like,
too
this
brilliant
is terrible,
to
and you're artist. Too amazing to write. I always remembered that comment. I thought that was
wow.
really, that was really great. But she, yeah, she's the one. Why do you teach?
That's a really maybe the best question I've ever been asked. Why do I teach? So I started to teach because I felt I had so many amazing teachers growing up, and I felt like it was my duty to pay it forward, and so I did it. As a giving back type thing, because unfortunately teaching doesn't pay that well and it's not exactly, you know, a moneymaker. But I went and got this job at Otis as a way, just as in a weird way, as a community service. I've been there now 10 years. Teaching did become, between projects, it's a consistent paycheck. The stuff I love teaching makes me a better writer and it just keeps me in touch with a different generation. And I will say to the students, remember when we, because once I was 22 and they were 20, and that is no longer the case. They are still 20. I am now, I just like being around that generation and just seeing what they're up to and hopefully giving them little crumbs.
Yeah, well, more than crumbs. They have a whole cookie.
We're hungry.
What was, do you have a memory of one of your best teachers and something that they taught you that you've never forgotten about in writing?
Oh, interesting. Okay. So my favorite teacher in elementary school was Mr. Levin, and it was less about writing and more about humor. He was really funny, witty, and he was just such a fabulous teacher in terms of his personality. And then another teacher that I'm thinking of that is also not about writing, even though you did not ask me that, was an art history teacher I had in college who really introduced me deeply to the Dada and Surrealist movement period in art. And I think that's less about writing and more about aesthetic. And I think my writing is sort of similar to that aesthetic. And she was just so passionate and dynamic, and she was an artist, and she really inspired me. In fact, I once wrote a letter to her when I was in grad school saying, like, I realized how much I've taken from her as a teacher now that I'm a teacher, and I never heard back from her, but I still love her. Her name was Joan Brigham.
Uh-huh.
She was an artist in Boston.
And what have you learned from both those people that you've kind of carried on into your own teaching technique?
I think it's about, you know, teaching is a performance, and I'm not necessarily a performer. I'm a writer. I like to hide behind the pen, the computer. But teaching has gotten me out more publicly in terms of performance. And when you write books and you go to these book festivals and conferences, and like there's a lot of public speaking, and I was always painfully, painfully shy. And so I think teaching has helped me. Definitely, I have lost the shyness. I've become really comfortable publicly. And I remember that from those two teachers, that they were just so comfortable and passionate and engaged and public. And I hope that I am 1/10 of what they were.
You've worked with a lot of young writers, many, many, thousands, maybe hundreds.
Mm-hmm. Thousands, probably.
Thousands.
Mm-hmm.
What advice, if they're thinking about getting into it professionally, do you have any advice that you tend to give them?
Yeah, I would say, I think reading would be the first piece of advice. You cannot just write to write. You need to read and see what's being written, what has been written, what's come before you, who are the giants in your field, learn from them. And then I would say that in terms of writing for television and for novels and stuff, it's not a steady life. It's very up and down and up again and then down again. And you really have to ride those curves and not let them sink you when they're down, because this is not a job at a bank that you go to every day from 9 to 5. This is, nothing's guaranteed, and steady is not the word I would use, at least for me. I mean, I guess maybe Stephen King has a very steady writing life, but...
Yeah, it's like the 0.001% probably.
Right. It's an illusion, that life. And so that's in part why I teach, is to keep it a little steadier in terms of... I teach a class called In Their Own Words, Artists Speak About Living a Creative Life, because you see that it vacillates. It's up and down. And I think your personality, you have to have the personality for that, or else it's going to sink you.
Tell me what you want readers to know about you. Like what do you have coming up that people can know about? I know you have a website.
I do. I have a new website. I have a teaching website, and it is www.melissaclarkteacheswriting, the longest handle you've ever typed
into
your
URL,
computer.
But it's very to the point. It's very on the nose.
MelissaClarkTeachesWriting.com. And I am posting 20-minute approximately sort of workshop things on there for a small fee. I have a flash fiction class on there, a class on beginnings, endings.
What is flash fiction?
Oh, flash fiction is a super, super, super short story.
Oh, wow.
Told very lean and concise, and has a lot of different names. But the one that is known is flash fiction. And Ernest Hemingway is known as sort of the grandfather of the flash fiction. You'll learn more on my website if you download that class.
Okay, great.
So yeah, I'm gonna host guest teachers as well, and I'm gonna put up a ton more classes up there. Right now, I think there may be 5 up there. I'll have some free content up there as well. So I would be thrilled if you would take a peek at it. I've worked very hard, and I have a regular website, MelissaClarkWrites.com. I don't know if I should say this, but allegedly, Braceface is coming back. Everything old is new again. And so even in the cartoon world, so I've been talking to the company that produced it in the first place, and looks like I'm going to be rolling out another 3 episodes that have yet to be sold. But, you know, hopefully we'll get a network or Netflix.
Will once again be animated?
It'll be animated. It'll be a girl. It will be the new generation. So it'll be my characters all grown up, and now they have kids, and it'll be the story of their kids.
Well, that's a cool idea.
Yeah. I'm probably giving away way too much.
And then the braces now are much different. They're sort of weird colors, and I don't think
right.
there's many rubber bands.
Yeah. Braces are different, and so is technology, so they can get into a lot more trouble. So
yeah.
Back then, you know, it's before cell phones the way we know them now and technology. So I'm excited to have fun with that in the future. And I teach one other thing I teach is a dream creativity class. I co-teach that with a Jungian dream person. And that's been new. And we're doing it mostly in LA right now, but we're going to hopefully be expanding that. And yeah, I'm trying to finish a 4th novel.
Well, Melissa Clark, thank you for joining.
Thank you. This was so much fun.
I had such a good time.
I love your podcast. I listen to it. And I think all your listeners should subscribe, because it is such a great podcast about writers and writing, and I can't wait to spread the word about it.
Oh, thank you for those kind words. Have a great day.
You too. Thanks. Bye.
Well, there you have it. Thank you, Melissa Clark, for being on Right About Now. Next week, I will fly all the way to New York to interview New York Times music critic Ben Ratliff. Really looking forward to catching up with Ben. We're actually high school friends. Haven't seen each other in quite some time, but have always kept in touch, and I have always admired his writing. If you're interested in being a music writer, you will want to tune into this podcast, because Ben is the Ben. I was going to say the man, but that doesn't really rhyme with Ben, and I couldn't think of a good rhyme. Anyway, Ben is an extraordinary writer, and I think you'll really enjoy that. But until that time comes, this is Jonathan Small reminding you to do the right thing.